Okay, so we are starting Tanya, and before we do, give an introduction as to what Tanya is. And to do that, we're given an introduction as to what Chassidus is. The Baal Shem Tov came on the scene as a Hasidic Rebbe in the 1730s. His philosophy emphasized five major points. The five things that the Baal Shem Tov emphasized, that became the tenets of the Hasidic thought, are, first of all, number one, serve Hashem with joy. Everything that a person does, they should look at it as an opportunity that's given to them to serve Hashem. And since you're given an opportunity to serve Hashem, and this has come to you, so you should do everything happy. That was the big thing. This was a new deal because at that time, European Jewry was a big drudge. Jews were cloistered into ghettos. They were barred from joining guilds and craft unions. They were limited in their travel. They were limited to what the professions they could do. They were, their lives were at the whims of the landowners. If a landowner said, "I don't want any Jews living in my property," just would kick them all out. So life was tough. So the Baal Shem Tov said, "No, you should be happy. For whatever reason you'll find to be happy, be happy." That's number one. Number two, davening, prayer, is a vehicle for self-improvement. Before the Baal Shem Tov, so it says in Shulchan Aruch, that a person has to daven before they can eat, they have to daven before they can learn, they have to daven before they can go to business. So therefore, davening was looked at as an interlude between getting out of bed and going to work, going to eat, and going to learn. Baal Shem Tov came and said, no. The men of the Great Assembly did not formulate the davening simply to get through, but rather each word of davening is a tool by which a person could be a better person. And indeed, the Baal Shem Tov says that when a person says a word of davening, he should say it with feeling like he's saying goodbye to someone, to a friend who he will never see again. Each word of davening. Okay? And the Baal Shem Tov also says that a person during davening should focus on one character trait and focus on it for a month. That they find something that they want, something about them they want to improve. So they should focus on it in davening for a month, and then after a month, see, should I do it for a second month, or maybe even a third month. But after 3 months of davening and working on a person, you should see a marked improvement in that one character trait that he's working on. And one at a time, even. You can't just daven, I want to be a better person. That's not, it's too general. Next. Torah study is tantamount of importance. A person should not go a single day without learning, and not just that a person should feel like he's just fulfilled an obligation, but a person should learn something which stretches their brain a little bit, whether it be Gemara, whether it be Chassidus, whether it be whatever it happens to be, because in doing so, when a person learns every day, they're connecting their will and wisdom, their own intellect, with the intellect of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the intellect of Hashem. So hence a person had to do that. The next thing, that everything that happens in this world is Ashkacha Pratis, it's divine providence. That Hashem said, Hashem made is making the world. The Baal Shem Tov's definition of divine providence extends to every microorganism. There's discussions in earlier philosophers as to how much is Hashem involved in the creation. But the only one that makes sense, if on analysis, and he does, the Alter Rebbe discusses this in the second chapter, second section of the Tanya, Shar Yehud Ve'amuna. The only thing that makes any sense really is going to be the Baal Shem Tov's definition that because God is continually involved with the creation, therefore the creation that's happening right now is the way in which Hashem wants it to be created. So when a person finds themselves in a situation, whatever the situation might be, it's by divine providence, by Hashgacha Pratit, that person is there. So the person therefore must realize that the world is being created right now for that person to be there, so they therefore must do something positive in this situation that Hashem has put them, regardless of what the situation may be. And the last one, which was the most eyebrow-raising, was that every person is equal. This was a very big, raised lots of flags, lots of red flags, because there was an, one second, I have to sneeze. Thank you, one second. There was at that time a schism that existed in Judaism. There was a split. You had the wealthy people and the scholars, and then you had the working class. And the only interaction that existed between the working class and this upper echelon was when the working class was working for a rich person or a scholar. That was the only thing they had to going back then. In the early 1700s, it was unheard of that a rich man's daughter should marry a milkman's son. It was almost to the point of two Judaisms. The working class, because they were working, they were uneducated. It says in Shulchan Aruch that society has an obligation to teach children until they're six. And after that, if a kid has the opportunity and the wherewithal, and the parents can afford it, so then they send them off to school. But otherwise, at age six, the kid was supposed to go make a living. So you had people, how much could a person know by age six? They could know how to read, they would know how to daven, they would know some chumash, maybe tillim, and that would pretty much be the extent of their knowledge of Judaism. Okay, so the Baal Shem Tov said, what makes a person Jewish is not their situation in life. It's not their social stature, it's their neshama. And everybody has, every Jew has the same neshama. So therefore, the milkman could even have a, quote unquote, a higher neshama, could have a soul, which is rooted from a higher place than the big scholar. This got the Baal Shem Tov in a lot of trouble because all these scholars are now saying, what are you talking about? This milkman's better than me? I'm sitting and learning Torah all day. So these were the five principles upon which the Hasidic movement was founded. Again, serve Hashem with happiness, learn Torah, emphasis on davening, divine providence, and everybody's the same. Those were those are the basic tenets of the Hasidic philosophy. After the Mizritcha Magid, the successor of the Baal Shem Tov, passed away, was nistalik, the Mizritcha Magid was nistalik, the students decided, rather than keeping one central Hasidic movement like had been with the Baal Shem Tov in Mezhebuzh and the Mizritcha Magid in Mizritch, so his students decided that they're all going to go back to their own hometowns and make the Hasidic philosophy that they learned, make it relevant to their communities. And each one of these students became a Rebbe, and each student, these Rebbes now, devised Hasidic philosophy, tailored it to the persona, the psyche of the people that they were dealing with. So the Alter Rebbe was in Lithuania and White Russia. There, the Jews were very intellectual. They were intellectually motivated. So the Alter Rebbe came up with and devised a Chassidus which was geared toward intellectualism, called, and he called it Chabad Chassidus. Chabad being abbreviation for Chochma, Bina, and Das, the faculties of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, meaning using the intellect. So other forms of Chassidus, the big branches, are called Chagas Chassidus, which comprises most of the other groups of Chassidus. Chagas stands for Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes. It refers to like the emotions. So the goal is that everybody is happy. And the question is, how do we get to be happy? So Chagas Chassidus, everybody except Chabad, are into like the pep rally. They daven loud, they dance a lot, they sing a lot, they have nice tishin, they have big parties, and they get really excited and they go home. Chabad, the emphasis is on intellect, that the intellect controls the emotions, and a person should be able to meditate and to think about the relationship they have between them and Hashem, and thus by develop this joy that they have in serving Hashem. Now, from the time that the Alter Rebbe set up shop, which would be after the passing of the Mezitra Magid, he passed away in 1773, so somewhere 1774 to 1776, he became Rebbe. So when he moved to the town of Lyoshna, they came to him and they said, "We want you to be a Rebbe." So he said, on one condition. The expression is that you don't hang on to my gartel. You know what a gartel is, yeah? Little belt thing that we wear. Okay, so what's the deal? Is in many of the Hasidic groups, the Rebbe is the one who's the tzaddik, and he has the relationship with Hashem. And as he improves his relationship to Hashem, so quote-unquote, his Hasidim are hanging on, and as the Rebbe goes up, so they go up as well. So the Alter Rebbe said, "I will be Rebbe, and what I will do is give you the tools, and you will do it yourself. You're not going to hang on to my gartel. I'm not taking that responsibility. You'll have to do it yourself." Okay, so over a period of some 20 years, people came to the Alter Rebbe and asked him questions. Well, how do I do this? This is such a new thing that we're talking about. No one ever conveyed these type of ideas before. So people would come to him and he would explain it. After about 20 years, he basically, it says in the introduction, got tired hearing the same question. So he says, if you're going to ask me the same question and I'm going to give you the same answer, if I write it down, then you'll be able to read it. You won't have to come bother me. And initially, the Tanya came out in what was referred to as kuntresim, little pamphlets. What happened, though, is there was a tremendous opposition against the writing of the Alter Rebbe, and people would forge the pamphlets. And in fact, the reason why there was such a hitnagdus, such an opposition from the Vilna Gaon, and why he was such a proponent or an antagonist to Chassidus, is because he had been given a forged pamphlet that had specifically written in it all kinds of mistakes. So the Tanya was written with absolute precision. The Alter Rebbe spent 20 years putting it together to make sure that it accomplished his goal. It says that he once spent 6 weeks on a vav, meaning vav means and. Do I want to put a period here and start a new sentence? Or is this a continuation from the previous sentence? That's the kind of thought that he put into writing the Tanya. And the Alter Rebbe writes in the introduction, which we're not going to learn, that what the purpose of writing the Tanya is to give people the tools, show them the tools that they have, that they should be able to serve Hashem properly, And he writes so much, he says, but wait, people are going to object to this. Why? Because up until now, I had a question. So what would I do? I would go off to the Alter Rebbe. I would have a yechidus. This was a special time. I got to be with the Rebbe. I got to talk with the Rebbe. So the Alter Rebbe writes that learning Tanya is like a yechidus. It's like having a private audience with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, with the Alter Rebbe. Okay, and indeed, the Alter Rebbe even posed, this became a tradition among Hasidim, if they couldn't get an answer to the Rebbe, for example, since they would sit and learn Tanya, and the answer would come from the learning of the Tanya that they were engaged in. So, we will start with the title page. So now I'll do the title page. And which starts Sefer Likutei Amorim. This is a book of collected sayings. Tanya has a couple names. First of all, the Alter Rebbe wanted to call it Likutei Amorim, collected sayings, as he emphasizes here over here, because he didn't make any of this up. There's nothing new in Tanya that doesn't exist someplace else. When I first came to Detroit, so I had taught a Tanya class to members of the Lakewood Kollel. It was like, shh, don't tell anybody, you know. And what I had to do for these guys, it was underground, what I had to do for these guys is I had to basically spend a lot of time looking up where things came from and telling them where this land came from, where's this line, where's that line, where's this idea from. There's one time I got stuck and one of the guys said, oh, that's from such and such. He knew where it was, you know. So every line in Tanya is written someplace else. What was the nuance? What's the chiddush of the Tanya? Is the way that the Alter Rebbe put it together. When the book was finished, so there is a rule that says if you write a Torah book, before you publish it, you have to send it to some known rabbi so he can write a haskama. He can write an approbation saying that this is a book worth buying, because I think it was in the late 1500s the Catholic Church was printing books in Hebrew that were presented like Hebrew books, like Jewish books, like Sfarim, and the whole purpose was that people would learn them and they would see how wonderful being a Catholic is. But it looked like a sefer, it looked like a Jewish book. So the rabbi said, for any book to be considered a Jewish book, so it has to have, till this day, it has to have some rabbi in the front of the book say that this book, I know this person, I read the book, and say it's an okay book. He sent a copy of the Tanya to Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who would eventually be his mechutin. His grandson married the Alter Rebbe's granddaughter. Levi Yitzchak Berdichev wrote back, I cannot give my haskama. I can't write anything about this book because I do not understand how you managed to squeeze such an infinite God into such a little book. That was the realization of this rabbi. Okay, so the book is called Likutei Amorim, is one of the name. Chelek Rishon as Nikra Sefer Shalbeinanim. The first section of it is called Sefer Shalbeinanim, the book of the middle guy. Now, middle guy doesn't mean the average guy. It doesn't mean the mediocre person. It doesn't mean the guy with the C average. Beinoni, so he discusses right in the first chapter, so you have tzaddikim. There are tzaddikim, there are righteous people, there are rishoyim, and there are wicked people. And then there are people who are not tzaddikim and not rishoyim. And those people get stuck in the middle. And the defining of what a Beinoni is already by the middle of the first chapter, he gives a good definition. And then the modus operandi of a Beinoni is discussed in chapters 12 and 13. So we call it, actually, we call it, you asked me, what did you learn with Rabbi Finman tonight? You'd say, I learned Tanya. says, why is it called Tanya? And that is the colloquial name. And if you look on the cover of the book, it says Tanya.
First part of the first chapter.
Yeah, is the first word. And very often in the name of the Parsha, okay, is going to be the first, or the name of a book in Chumash, is going to be the first important word in that Parsha or that Chumash. Elu Shmos. So the book is called Shmos, even though it's got nothing to do with names, but it's called that because it's a Breshith, etc., Mishpatim, Elu Mishpatim, etc. Because so now the Tanya is called Tanya because the first word starts, the first word of the book is Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. And we'll talk about that when we get to why he did that. But then he qualifies it. Melukat mipi svarim umapi seifrim. It is gathered. Why is it called Lakute Amarim, collected sayings? Because he gathered it from a whole lot of books. Of course, Tanakh, Bible, and Mishnah, and Gemara, and Medrash, and Zohar, and Kabbalah books, and a whole plethora, a whole wealth of printed materials. Umipis, like for example, especially the writings of the Shelah HaKodesh, who passed away in 1698. He passed away the year the Baal Shem Tov was born. He wrote a book called Shnei Luchas HaBris, which is an esoteric insights into the portion of the week, into holidays and other things. And also the writings of the Maharal of Prague, who also passed away in the year 1598. And he wrote, again, an insightful philosophy on various parts of the Torah. And then also Mepi Seferim, Kedushay Elyon, Nishmasay Eden. And also from things that I heard from the mouth of holy scribes, meaning holy teachers, based on the teachings of the Baal Shem Tov, the Maggid of Mizrich, his teacher, and also for a short time, the successor to the Maggid of Mizrich was Menachem Mendel Haradoker. Menachem Mendel Haradoker in 1777 decided he did not want to be the leader of this new group, and he picked himself up and moved to Israel, where he is buried in, I want to say Tveria, I'm not mistaken. Okay, so these are the people that the Alter Rebbe called his teachers. Then he says, well, what are we doing in this book? It says, Miyusid al Pasik, Kikarav Elecha Hadavar Oid, Vefichol Uvavcha Lasaisai. It is based on the verse which appears in Parshas Nitzavim. Moshe says, don't say, Mi Yala Hashemaima, who's going to go up to the heavens and bring it back to us? Who's going up to the highest mountain? Who's going to cross the ocean to bring it back to us? Because kikarav elacha hadavar ma'od b'fichol levav ilcha ulasaisei. Because it is very close to you in your mouth and your heart to do it. Meaning, what's it? It means to fulfill all the precepts of the Torah the way that they're supposed to be fulfilled. Being, quote unquote, a proper Jew. And he says that it's very close to you, is what he's going to emphasize over here. It's very easy. And he says, Lover Heitiv Echu Karav Ma'ud. And he says, I'm going to explain, how is it very easy to say that, to be, do all the 613 commandments and do it in such a way that the Baal Shem Tov demanded? So you're going to tell me that's easy? And not only going to tell me that's easy, you're going to tell me that's very easy? So he's going to explain, yes, it's very easy. And indeed, the Alter Rebbe has a guarantee. Guaranteed. The first section of the Tanya is 53 chapters. If you do what it says in the 53 chapters of Tanya, you will become a Beinoni. You will achieve your full potential. Guaranteed. All you have to do is do it. Yes. Okay, as he says, he'll say later. And he says, B'derech arucha kitzara be'ezus Hashem yizbarach. And he says, he explains it in a long way and a short way. The long way is actually short, and the short way is actually long. And an example is given, guy comes to the big city, the capital city. Okay, and he's got an appointment at the palace, but he doesn't know his way around the big city. So he sees a kid and he asks the kid, how do I get to the palace? So the kid tells him, well, there's a short way which is long, and there's a long way which is short. So the guy says, I don't know what you're talking about. Just tell me the shortest way to get there. So he says, fine. You go down that street right there, and the palace is right there. So he says, what are you hocking me a chinik about? What's your problem, kid? You know, so he goes, walks down the street, and he sees the palace in front of him, but there's a 12-foot wall between him and the palace. So he comes back and he says, what are you telling me over here? How do you get the palace over there? What kind of short way is that? He said, kid says to him, if you know how to climb a wall or pole vault, you're right there. He says, okay, what's the long way which is short? So he says, you go down 3 blocks, and you make a right turn, you go down 4 blocks. You make another right turn, you go down 1/2 block, and you'll be at the entrance to the palace. Okay, so now, the long way, which is short, is chapters 1 through 18. 1 through 18 is a unit. They're actually, the Tanya, the 53 chapters are broken into units. You have chapters 1 through 17, chapters 18 to 25, 26 to 34, sometimes you'll say 33, 34, it's a discussion on that one. 34, 35 to 40, 41 to 50, 41 to 49, and then 50 to 53. Okay, they're each units. Every chapter of the Tanya is a continuation of the previous chapter, but every chapter of Tanya is its own thing. So it's possible that a person can jump into learning Tanya wherever you happen to be, and if a person misses, so they're not going to lose that much from the fact that they don't see the continuum, they're not going to get the continuum, but each chapter is its own thing, and it's can be learned in and of itself. So with that, now we will start Tanya. So at this point we're going to skip a bunch of pages, so that we're on page A, on the top pages, which would be the same as page 9, or the page before page 9. Page 10 has a 10 on the top of it. Page hay has a hay on the top of it. So it says, Tanya b'seif perek gimel denida. It says, we learn in a braisa, and the end of the third section, the third chapter of Masechta Nida, in the Gemara, which is called Nida. Now, before we go any further, I'm going to stop here. So as we said before, that the reason why Tanya is called Tanya is because it starts with the word Tanya. As we just said, Tanya b'sei perek gimel denida. We learn in a braisa at the beginning. Now, but there's a problem. We mentioned in the class before this, in our Gemara class, that there's many ways to say we learn in Hebrew. Just like the Eskimos have like 15 words to say snow, and in English there are 50 ways to say drunk. In Hebrew, there's over a dozen ways to say learn. You know, we have Lomod, we have Mishnah, we have Gamar, we have other things, Tanan, Tana, all these different things. And then they have different, you conjugate them to mean, sometimes what they mean. So if you actually go look this footnote up in the third chapter of Nida, which is going to be page 30, side 2, you will see that when it says over there, Mashbim Aisi Tei Tzadik V'Alti Yerusha, that they make the soul swear to be righteous and not be wicked, is actually part of a Mishnah. It's not part of a braisa. So if that be the case, then the word should not say Tanya, we learn in a braisa. It should say Tanan, we learn in a Mishnah. Now, we also just said that the Alter Rebbe wrote this, took him 20 years to write it. He spent 6 weeks on a Vav, and here the very first word is the wrong word. says, no. The Alter Rebbe wanted to bring out certain things because knowing that the first word of the first chapter was going to be the name in which the book was called, decided rather than calling it Tanan, to call it Tanya. By the way, also, the Alter Rebbe deliberated if this section we're doing now should be the first section, or if the second section, which talks about creation and how God created the world and the event, advent of Hashgacha Pratis, if that should be the first. And there was it went right down till it went to the publisher. And he finally decided, no, it's more important that people should know who they are, what they are, and what they have to do, rather than how we got here. So he put that second. So Tanya, it says, is put for a couple, is called for a couple of reasons. One reason is so he talks about in chapter 6 that there's something called the forces of evil. And the forces of evil are directed at us. The purpose of the forces of evil is to keep us from doing the right thing. Okay. In other words, it's to give us free choice. It's because how could you make a choice to do something right if there's nothing wrong? So in order to make the right choice, Hashem had to create a wrong choice. So the one of the klippas that's out there, some of them have names, and I don't know how they all come up with names and whatnot, but there's a klippa called Tanya. What's the klippa called Tanya? There's a clip out there that says, why are you learning this deep Torah? You should be learning, you're just a beginner. You should be learning Chumash. You should be learning Shulchan Aruch. You should be learning Gemara. You shouldn't be learning this. This is for people who are very smart people who have like a whole basis in knowledge and Torah, and they know and they understand everything. What are you doing this for? And indeed, the Alter Rebbe, when he wrote this, to get into the Alter Rebbe's first grade of his yeshiva, the person had to be totally and completely thoroughly knowledge in Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, the major Midrashim, and the Zohar. That was just to get in the front door. Those were the prerequisites to apply. Okay, in addition to that. So the Alter Rebbe was initially writing the Tanya for those type of people. So, but the Alter Rebbe said there's going to come a time when you're going to have people sitting in Ferndale, and some of them are not going to know an aleph from a base, and you're going to say to them, hey, let's learn Tanya. And someone's going to say to that person, why are you learning Tanya that's running before you're learning even how to crawl? So that is the klippa. It's exactly that the Alter Rebbe wanted to combat by writing the Tanya. And the Alter Rebbe absolutely thoroughly believed that everybody should be learning these concepts. And indeed, when I was getting involved with religion, so Chumash didn't turn me on. Shulchan Aruch I thought was cute. Gemara I had absolutely no use for. No, I couldn't figure what was going on over there. So, you know, what's Judaism got for me? I'm going to become a Buddhist. Until I came to Tanya. And Tanya showed me, oh, Judaism has what it's supposed to have. Now, it's not often that the Alter Rebbe quotes a footnote in the text. But here he specifically says, B'seif Perek Gimel de Nida. The end of the third chapter of Nida, but without quoting a page, because it's not important. Masechta Nida deals with all the laws of a menstruant woman. The word Nida means exile. Because when a woman is having her period, so the husband and wife don't touch, they can't have relations. So it's like she is in a state of exile from her husband. So if you're going to translate now the word Nida here as exile. So it says, now we're going to read it, we learn at the end of the third chapter of exile, there have been till now three Gulluses. There is Gullus Mitzrayim. There was which the Egyptian exile. There was Gullus Bubble, the Babylonian exile. And then there's the present exile, which is the Roman exile. So a person could say, listen, before 1796, nobody learned Tanya. Jews were fine. My great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather never learned Tanya. He was Jewish. What do I have to learn this for? So it says no. When, immediately before Mashiach's arrival, I don't know how immediate, it says the gates of knowledge open up, and it says in the Zohar that actually in the 600th year of the 6th millennia, which was 1840-ish, the gates of knowledge will open up in both the Torah and in the world. So 1840 is about the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the beginning of the modern inventions, and the Zohar says that knowledge will grow exponentially until Mashiach comes. To fulfill that which the Rambam writes, that the earth will be filled with the knowledge of God like the water fills the seas. So, okay, so there may have been a time when people didn't need to learn Tanya. But it's something called Yerides Hadoros, that every generation is on a lower level, and the darkness of the Gullus is that much worse. And therefore, we need to be learning Tanya, whereas our great-great-grandparents didn't, because things for them spiritually weren't so bad. So what the Tanya does now is supplies, you might say, the beacon to get us through the Gullus. So we'll finish up, we'll learn the first statement, the topic statement. So the way Hasidic discourses work, and many Pilpulim also work like this, is the discourse will start quoting a verse or quoting some statement from the Talmud. It will then ask a bunch of questions on it. It will then go on a tangent, and the tangent will take another bunch of tangents until finally we come back to the enough with this, all this information. We come back, we can answer the original question. So he's going to ask a series of questions. He's then going to go on a series of tangents, and the questions are not answered until chapter 12. But I'll remind you what the questions were when we get up to chapter 12. So first, what's this topic statement? Mashbi Maisti Tate Tzadik Valtei Rasha. It says that the soul, before it is born, 40 days before the soul is born, it is brought before the Almighty, and the Almighty plans out the entire life of this soul. When is it going to be born? When is it going to die? Who is it going to marry? How many kids is it going to have? What's its IQ going to be? How much money is it going to make? Where is it going to live? All of this is bashert. What's not planned out? Is this person going to be a good person or a bad person? Because we have the freedom of choice that's not pre-programmed in us to make a decision, a good decision or a bad decision. So what happens to the soul? So it's administered an oath. Be righteous and don't be wicked. And the purpose of administering an oath such as this is supposed to give a person a bit of a push to fulfill this idea. If a person says, I'm not going to eat cookies, is one thing. If a person says, I swear I will never eat cookies, that now becomes a solemn statement. That's got a lot of heavy weight to it. So the soul is made to swear, I won't be bad. I won't be a Rasha. Okay? We can ask ourselves now, so what does that help us? This he talks about later. So the Gemara continues, but even if the whole entire world says, you are a tzaddik, you should consider yourself to be a wicked person. Why? Because there's a rule. Anybody who pats themselves on the back and says, I am righteous, we know one thing about the guy. He's not. So a person can never say in Judaism, I'm there. I'm perfect. Because what happens as soon as a person says they're perfect, they basically just died. Because they're not going to improve. And if a person's not improving, they're getting worse. How so? You have a person, let's say this house that we're in was owned by a dentist. 1950. This house was built, the dentist moved in. He had all the latest equipment from 1950 put into the building. Okay? And let's say that this guy's a dentist from 1950, and since then he has never upgraded his equipment, and he never went to a conference to learn how to improve his dental skills. What would you call this dentist? Antiquated. Okay, those dentist chairs from 1950, you could put it in a museum. But in 1950, it was perfect. He didn't make it backwards. He didn't, 10 years later, put in a chair from 1940. He kept his 1950 chair. But since the world is progressing, he's going backwards if he doesn't keep up and keep improving. So it's the same thing now. So that if a person thinks that they're perfect, they have nothing more to improve, guess what? They're going backwards. We'll stop. We'll go up a couple further. Up to Ach Inyan. V'tzarech lahavin. It says, now we're going to ask a question about this. The Hatnan Avos Perek Beis. We learned in the Mishnah, this is in the Mishnah, in Ethics of Our Fathers in Chapter 2. Al ti rosher bifnei atzmach. It says there, so what did we say? The previous Gemara said, you should always consider yourself to be a wicked person lest you become haughty. But there's another Mishnah that contradicts that and says, wait, don't ever consider yourself to be wicked. V'gamiyya be'ein of kirasha, because what's going to happen if a person says, oh, I'm wicked? It says, yir levav, v'yiyya etzav, v'lochli l'avdas Hashem b'simcha v'tuv levav. He's going to get despondent. I'm a wicked person. I'm a terrible person. I'm terrible. I shouldn't be born because I'm so terrible. So he's not going to be able to serve Hashem with joy, which is number one tenet from the Baal Shem Tov. V'im lo yir levav klal nizeh. And if he doesn't get upset from it at all, the fact that he is nothing more than a wicked person, yachal l'dei kaos chas v'shalom. He might come to frivolity and say, well, if I'm a wicked person, let me go out and be a real wicked person. Let's go join myself. So Pirkei Avos admonishes the person, never be wicked. In Masechta Nida, it says a person should always consider themselves to be wicked. In Pirkei Avos, it says you should never be considered yourself wicked. Both statements are true. Come back next week and we'll discuss how. To be continued. Yeah.